My guest today is Yolanda Sanguini, right?
Yes.
Sanguini.
You got it.
And she is a writer, editor, she's a singer, and the editor of Afropop magazine. You just have, like, all of these amazing creative strands mm-hmm. are on your platform and seem to be blended together beautifully. So I'm interested in how you, your story to how you became an editor at Essence, obviously, yeah. but really also in terms of all the other projects that you're doing, in terms of Afropop magazine, your life as a singer, as yeah. a performer. So I wanted to start with this really beautiful piece that you wrote recently that was in Essence.com mm-hmm. called Coming to America, My Journey from Refugee to Essence Editor. So could you just tell us a little bit about your kind of origin story and how you came to move to America? I found that story to be really beautiful.
Oh, well, I was born in South Africa, Durban, and my mother she became political later on in her life. So from when I was born, she was a businesswoman, so she owned a supermarket in a small little town on the coast of South Africa called Port St. John's. And then she decided she was going to go back to school. At this point, she's a mother of four. So everyone in, you know, her college is like 20, you know, not even 20, like in the teens. I mean, 19, 20, okay.
And how old is she at this point?
At this point, she's probably like 40 or like 39, 40. And she had never gone to college when she was younger. So she left her business. Because I was young, I don't know the exact time that she became politicized, but I think it was during college, or maybe it happened before, because she passed away 3 years ago, and I now am hearing more stories about what she was doing when she was... that's when things got a little bit heated for our life, because, you know, now you're challenging the South African white government, and she became a target. At this point, she had gone to University of Natal to pursue her master's. And that's when it got really hot. You know, it was the thing where I found out later that she was always being taken, not always, but she would occasionally be taken by police to be questioned. And then the one time they took her in, basically booked her and arrested her and kept her, was the time that they came to the house and then they took me with them. And the whole thing was like, why are you taking this woman's child to jail with her? So at the jail, they were interrogating her, and they brought in this man who was like my uncle, who I thought, and I put uncle in quotes because you know how in Africa,
with African people, everyone's an uncle.
This guy was like a trusted.
The scary neighbor is an uncle.
Yeah, like,
there are uncles
uncle.
Everywhere.
Why? That's your uncle. Shut up. So he basically was. We found out he was someone that they, you know, they asked him, "Is that her?" And he was like, "Yes, that's her." You know, at that time they took her in for 6 months. And at that point, I was 10. I wrote about it in the piece. I was like, you know, 6 months doesn't seem like a long time to an adult. But I was very close to my mother, extremely close to her. When she was gone those 6 months, it was very difficult. And then to know, you know, when you're a kid, a 10-year-old, it's like, and I lived, because she was imprisoned, I had to live with her white friends. Oh, this is apartheid South Africa. So now right. they took me to some private school and people would ask, well, who are those white ladies?
Yeah.
Two white ladies that, you know.
And was this a segregated school or
was it mixed?
Okay.
So they would ask, you know, who are those white ladies? I'd be like, oh, you know, my mom works for them. Mm. I mean, which is BS. I still get very angry at myself for doing that at that time.
But do you have a sense of why you said that?
Yeah, because I thought, how else do you explain why I'm this little black girl living with two white women
So at that age, you had an understanding of the power structures and the way worked in South Africa.
Yeah.
That would be like the answer that you would.
Yeah, I think also, which I always say to people who grew up, you know, in places like Nigeria, I read, you know, Chimamanda saying that she didn't know about the whole idea of being black, right? Because when you live in a nation of all black people, you just like, what is that? You know, I'm just human being. But then when you live in South Africa and the white power structure is always telling you you're black. So we grew up knowing very well of our blackness and how the otherness of our blackness. Oh, and the two white women that I was living with were lesbians. So you can imagine, it was a lot. Right?
Interesting.
It was a lot. And I'm still friends with her. I still keep in touch with them. I would love to one day, like, I was thinking I need to write a book or something about that relationship because they really took care of me very well. They really fought very hard for my mother, which taught me also that the color of justice and people who seek justice, it's not about race. You know, there are many people outside of, in South Africa, there were many white people who fought, you know, and helped other. My mother came out like 6 months later, and we knew what was going to happen is that if she gets out, they're probably going to come back, the police, because that's what they did. They would let you out and then they'd come right back and pick you up and be gone. My mom's sister lived in Harlem, and she had been writing to Amnesty International, the organization, to get them interested in doing a letter writing campaign for my mom. Actually, I remember she used to talk about this one, because she would get the letters. Some of them would write the letters to the police, but then they'd write the letters to her. And she always talked about this one woman, Cecilia someone, that lived in like London. And she just kept that letter with her because she thought it was so unbelievable that someone who had never met this poor black woman in South Africa, that she would write to her, you know, continually to pray for your freedom and things like that. So we got here to America because of Amnesty International.
Well, and you said in the piece that you came with $49.
Yeah, because my mother at that point, she hadn't been working anywhere, and, you know, and whatever monies were collected, they were collected to buy the plane ticket. So when we got here, we didn't have anything. And so in her passport, they asked, you know, basically how much money do you... And it was written $49. Mm. We were refugees with, you know, and political asylum. And we... In the 80s, Africans were really like... the shit.
Maligned.
It was like,
you know, it was like, do they know it's Christmas?
Yeah.
Do they know
like
snow?
Now everyone's wearing like, you know, so quote unquote African print thing and like celebrating them. Like, girl,
an African jungle bunny. I don't know if you were called that, but I certainly was.
All kinds of names.
Yeah.
It was cruel.
Yeah.
So we moved, we came in 80s Harlem from like this somewhat tropical place where, you know, we went to the beach, there was like mangoes and lychees, and that's kind of life that I grew up in. To be taken from that and then go straight to Harlem, which was like, what tree? Where, what?
Concrete.
What tree are you talking about?
What mango? Where are the mangoes?
Crack era Harlem.
Oh, wow, yes.
I remember, I think there was like, they were playing like Eddie Murphy movies in South Africa at that time. I thought, okay, when you get to America, it's gonna be like this.
Yeah.
You know, you come out of the airport, it's going to be like music playing, and it's going to be like this like really exciting place, and then you get here and it's dark and people
snowy.
Are not friendly. Yeah, and we came in July. I remember July 23rd.
Isn't that funny how you always remember the day you arrived in America? Ours was August 5th, 1991.
Wow.
Yeah, my family.
Yeah.
It's like seared in my memory.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to heaven. I remember.
Me
little now. Did I know.
Yeah, so we got here, and I remember the first day I went to public school. In South Africa, girls, when I was growing up, you couldn't have long hair. They would make you cut your hair.
Yeah, into a boy.
Yeah, so everyone had short hair. So I had very short hair when I came here. And it was obviously, we didn't do any relaxing or whatever. So I came, and I had, like, the worst clothing. Like, you know, because we had nothing, right? So it was like the clothes didn't fit. First day of school, this girl was like, God damn, she got a big booty. And then everyone was like laughing. And look at her hair. And it was like a big like joke, right? And everyone started like, oh my God, now I'm going to cry about it. Because it was so sad. And I was the only, Busayo, really? It makes me so sad.
I've had the same,
girl.
I had the same experience.
They were so cruel.
And I remember my mom, she had given me this outfit that was like Nigerian Adira clothing,
yeah.
Which is crazy because that's now what I sell and make. And I wore it to school and people laughed.
So
and I remember going home and saying like to my mom, like, why did you make me wear this horrible shirt?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Just saying, I never want to wear anything from Nigeria ever again.
Oh my gosh. Did you stop?
I stopped. Absolutely.
My goodness.
I stopped for years.
Wow.
Absolutely.
It's painful. I feel like if you go to, if you take your child from America and you put them in a South African or a Nigerian or anywhere else, I don't think they'll be scrutinized or ridiculed or done the same way. Like my sister moved from here when she was 12 and moved to South Africa. It was not the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like this othering and like taunting and... It was a torment. Like I was tormented by that environment.
And was this a predominantly black or white?
Predominantly black, black school and white. In Harlem.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was tough. Mm. I remember because I didn't speak that great of English. I mean, I spoke English, but it wasn't like great. And obviously you'd get made fun of for that. And then...
What tribe are you, by the way?
I'm Xhosa.
Okay, right. And did your mother, some kind of like artistic or kind of, creative bent to her own aspirations in any way? Or
no.
So what was she doing when she got here?
So when she came here, she was an immigrant, 40-something-year-old woman from South Africa. Nobody's rushing to give you a job. So she started cleaning people's houses. She would talk about, you know, I have a master's and I'm cleaning people's houses, right? But I don't remember my mother ever feeling sorry for herself about it because of her situation. Because my mother, what I also learned from her is that your circumstance and also the currency of people, right? So her whole thing was like, if I meet you, Busayo, and I'm cleaning your home, girl, what can you do for me? You know, like,
yeah.
She just had that ability to be like, okay, fine, I'm cleaning your home, but next thing you know, you and I are best friends, and you're helping me put this application here, and this. So that's how she was. So she started here cleaning. At one point, she was cleaning this artist's studio, and then her and that artist became like the closest of friends, and then that artist introduced her to someone else, who introduced her. So it became like this thing where she finally was introduced to someone who could help her get into Hunter College. So she ended up going back to Hunter College to finish her master's. Things kind of opened up for us.
So when did you have a sense that you wanted to be a writer?
I went to a Quaker high school upstate, and sophomore, we were introduced to the novel Beloved by Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? A black woman can do this. I remember immediately being so attracted to like what she did, who she was. I applied to Howard University because she went to Howard University. I was like, I want to be Toni Morrison. So that's when I think it was between my sophomore and junior year in high school. I was like, I want to write. But my thing, I thought I wanted to be a novelist like Toni. I wanted to do everything like Toni. I read all her books before, you know, college. I read like Sula and Song of Solomon and Beloved and
Jazz.
Yes, yeah. And Jazz. And this was before the internet, so I had no idea. So she was the catalyst.
And did you start writing at that time? Or
I did, but it was like, I mean, you know.
Essays.
Yeah. No, it was like, Dear Black Woman. You know?
When For Colored Girls came out too, right? And there's all this snap poetry.
Yeah, it was very basic, like,
yeah.
You know, like, I thought I was, like, Dozake Shange, like, all those women, I thought, you know, I could be like them. So they helped. They really, really, and it was wonderful because the people teaching me about these women were white people, because my high school was mostly white faculty, but a lot of them were very passionate about Morrison and Maya Angelou and
Alice Walker.
Oh my gosh. These were all the women. Even though it was a predominantly white environment, I learned a lot of my blackness, about my blackness, about what my blackness in an American context.
That distinction that you just made, can you tell me a little bit more about that? Like blackness in an American context as opposed to like blackness generally?
In an African, Well, I was comparing it to African, right? Because I think like Ntozake was saying, Chimamanda says, when you're black in a mostly black nation, you're going through a lens of, you know, when I'm in South Africa, I know who I am, right? I know where I am. I know where my ancestors land. And that psychologically does something different to you than being in a place where I was used to white people in South Africa, obviously looking down on you. But there's a different sort of racism in America that is not as overt. In South Africa, you know they don't like you, right? And here, it's like a different type of it's a very quiet racism that you don't necessarily know. I didn't know what to look for.
Yeah.
And so I think when I say my blackness in the American context, because those books gave me the blueprint of what to look for, because I didn't know. So I was going into a situation very naive and thinking, oh, you know, I'm going to this liberal white school, everything's going to be like hunky-dory, these people are so nice, they're Quakers, they believe in peace and love, and
and quiet time.
Yeah, oh, I love quiet time. Oh my God, I love quiet time. I wish my kids could.
So you go to Howard,
yeah,
emulating Tony, and are you are you writing while you're there, or
no?
Okay, so you did you?
I think my first year, I only went there for 1 year.
Oh,
yeah, I went there for 1 year, and I was like, oh no, I am finding myself if in this blackness. So I didn't write a lot. I think I lost the point of why I went there. When I went, when I was there, I kind of lost the point. I was so happy to be around like these fly black people, you know, like a lot of my friends were like, you know, poets or like they were singers and things like that. And I really, really enjoyed being around that. I don't think I focused on my studies. And also, you know, in high school is when I discovered that I was a creative, because I never was taught or allowed, not even allowed, because that's not the word. There was no space for creative pursuits, you know, because it was like, it was such a hot political environment in South Africa. Like, I don't remember any of us taking time to be like, let's go drawing or painting, or, oh my God, that child's an artist. Like, that was not even a conversation that was had. And I don't say, like, we always say, you know, some of us say, oh, African parents didn't do this, didn't. You know, I understand. They did not have this bandwidth to be like, on top of this revolution and this, like, boycotting, I'm going to be teaching my kid to be an artist. Like, from in my experience, it just was not, I didn't know anyone that was kind of living like that. Mm. You know, it was a very, it was all about like politics and religion and your family.
Well, I read something that you, is I think it was an interview on a blog, and I can't, where you said as an adult, you've never had a job that you didn't love to do. Do you remember saying this?
Yeah.
And I read that and I sat with that and I thought, that is amazing. Yeah. If there's one thing that this podcast and this work is about, is really helping people get to that point where they would be able to say that and say that unabashedly. Realizing you're an artist at that age and then essentially getting here, but really on the way, not doing anything that you didn't love to do.
Yeah, no, I've never done anything I didn't love to do. I don't know what that is. I think it's... So I left Howard. A year later, I enrolled.
Why did you leave Howard?
Was between my grades and the cost. At that point, we didn't have, I didn't have any kind of scholarship, or, and my mother hadn't even finished paying for my high school.
Girl. Wow.
Listen.
She's an amazing lady.
We ended up back in South Africa because my mother moved back in 97. She moved. And I remember I went to visit her, and she was living in this beautiful apartment, beachfront apartment. And I was like, wait, now why am I going back to New York again, to the place with no windows? So basically, I ended up moving back to South Africa, and I got my degree at the University of Natal, which is, I got it in English, a degree in English. And then, as soon as I finished college, like I got my, as soon as I got my degree, I knew I wanted to write, like I said, but I didn't know what form of writing I would do. I left college, and my first job out of college was teaching English to first year students at Wits Technikon, which is like a technical college.
In Durban?
In Johannesburg. So I moved and lived in Johannesburg and started teaching for a year.
Okay.
And I love teaching. I love teaching. Like, if I could, I would teach as well. But that's like a lot. So I did it for a year. And then from there, I got an opportunity to do an internship at a TV station. It was a fairly new TV station called ETV in South Africa. And it was a year's paid internship, and it was in Cape Town, Johannesburg.
Gorgeous.
I was like, I'm going to Cape Town.
No question.
So I taught for that year. And at this point, I recognized that writing doesn't have to mean one thing, right? You could be a TV writer. You could be a news writer. You could. So I thought, okay, maybe I can try this news writing thing.
And the opportunity at the TV, did that come out of the blue? Was this something you sought out? Is this... Like, how did that
It was through...
happen?
When my mother was a teenager, she, because it was the norm in South Africa for teen, black teen girls to take care of Indian or white children, right?
Hmm.
To supplement her income, she would take care of this little Indian boy named Kanthan, right? And he ended up being one of the executives at ETV.
Hmm.
And they had kept in touch all those years. So basically, she was his nanny. And that's how I got the ETV thing. So it was through a family connection. And I, at one point, I was like, oh my God, everyone's going to know that, you know, it's nepotism because I know Kanthan. And she was like, fuck that. That's what the white people do, okay? The white people hook each other up.
Yeah.
You better learn to hook people up. And then Oprah magazine came out in South Africa.
Right.
And I wanted to write an article about having a big booty growing up in America and then to return home to South Africa where everyone has a big booty, because here I was always ostracized for having a big booty or sexualized from a very young age for having a big booty, and then returning to South Africa where everyone has a big booty. So it's like, what big booty? Like, yours has nothing, it doesn't compare to so
it's like, what makes you special?
I know you're not special. So I wrote this piece and I just kept it to myself because I didn't know where I could publish it. And then there was this woman, her name was Taweni Gondwe. She was the editor of Oprah magazine, South Africa. And I saw her and I was like, what? So she was this woman from Malawi. She was a writer. And she had been handpicked by Oprah to be the first editor of her South African edition. I was like, oh my God, I want to be friends with her. So Cape Town is really small, especially when you're black and you work in
There's
arts.
Like no black people there.
There are, but you know, it's like when you work in the arts, then it's even smaller because everyone knows each other, right? There are a lot of black people in Cape Town. They're just marginalized, like you wouldn't believe. That's another podcast.
Yeah, we may have
sad.
To do a part two.
It is really sad. One day, I was in the bathroom of a restaurant. This is so funny.
I'm loving this story.
I was in the bathroom, so I always thought, like I said, my mom always told me you should always like have some, you know, like be cool to people and then make connections all the time. So I was always, my whole life has been like, oh, I gotta make connection. So I, oh no, I saw her walking into
the bathroom.
So who goes to the bathroom?
I don't know. You're allowed to have to pee.
Wait, and sits in the stall and waits for her to come out of the stall.
Oh my God.
So then when she comes out, I happen to come out as well. I was like, hello.
Hi. Fancy seeing you here.
So then I pitched her that piece and she loved it.
Mm.
And she published it in the Oprah magazine. At that time, publishing in South Africa was going through a real change because it had traditionally, a lot of the sort of mainstream magazines were white women's magazines. Like Cosmo was all, had a magazine called Femina, which was like I don't know, Red Book, right? And they were looking for a writer. But what they didn't want to say publicly is that they wanted one who was black because the environment was changing. You needed people who could write content that reflected the nation for once. Basically, someone had read that piece that I wrote in Oprah and they were like, oh, call her. Basically, that's how I ended up actually making writing as, you know, writing for magazines as my main form of getting money.
Yeah.
Main career.
And then when did you move back to America from South Africa?
I moved back here in 2004.
Okay. And
so it's been 11 years.
What prompted that?
Well, I had met my husband a long time ago when I was younger here. And so we had dated for a little bit. But we were not too. By the time I went back to South Africa, we weren't together. But he would come visit all the time. It happened. Like, we started going out again. And then we got married. And then I moved back here with that sort of thinking, you know, I've worked for these magazines in South Africa. Somebody's going to, like, it's not going to be that hard.
Yeah.
When you come back.
And was it that
what?
Hard?
What? Listen, it was so difficult.
Huh.
It was so difficult.
So how did you do it? How did you end up at Essence?
Well, I came back, and then back in 2004, it's not even that long ago, 2004, I was coming here like, oh, here are my clips, you know, I'm a writer, journalist, can you like assign me stories and things like that? And people would
just
like,
cold call, you would cold call magazines
cold call,
or try to find relationships?
I really advise people cold calling is one of the best ways to get in the door. So I thought, okay, Elle is looking for an associate editor, and I submit my application. Girl, nobody's gonna, they're like, what? South Africa, what? You know? So I knew, I was like, okay, after a year of trying to get a job, like a legitimate job in publishing, I decided, let me go the internship, right? Because an internship always helps you at least get, you know, inside the publishing world, and they don't have to pay you. So it's not like a big risk on their part. And at that point, I was 27. So no one's going to hire a 27-year-old intern.
You're too old.
I'm too old.
Yeah.
Called the small magazine. It used to be called Budget Living. Do you remember Budget Living? And basically, Budget Living was my key. It let me in. They let me in. They let me be an intern for a few months, I think. And then the receptionist was leaving. So I basically got her job. And then they shut down. I was like, oh my God. This must have been like 6 months like after
the universe is conspiring against you.
I was like, what is happening? And then an old boss of mine from South Africa was working on a supplement. You know, remember we used to get supplements in the magazine, and it'd be like, it'd be Harper's Bazaar, and then there'd be a little supplement.
Yeah, the random one that would
come
with that.
So she was working on a supplement, and she was a white woman from South Africa. We used to work in the same company in South Africa, and she has been really one of my guiding lights, right? Because wherever she went, she would always be like, hey, you know, she would always be finding a way to help. And she was like, I'm going to get my girl in here with my, you know, whichever way I can.
With my power.
Yeah. So she got me into work with her at Harper's Bazaar on a supplement. And then from there, I saw a job, or someone told me about a job at Trace Magazine. And then I applied, and then I got
that's a music
job.
Magazine, right?
Yeah. They folded as well.
Yeah.
So I worked at Trace for about 2 years, 2.5 years. Then they folded. I was like, what the hell?
I'm jinxing.
What's happening? So I was basically out of a job for about a year and a half.
After Trace.
And I was pregnant.
Oh, my God.
So that's when Afropop came around. Because I was like, okay, the universe right now, I don't have work that pays in that sort of very lucrative way. So I was like, and blogging was really kind of starting up at that point. So I was home pregnant with my baby, and I gave birth to Afropop at the same time. Because I was like, I wanted a place where the Africa that I had been conditioned to believe, even as an African, was like this sort of like, you know, it was like this wasteland of like, there was no like creativity, you know, kind of the way it's portrayed, yeah. Even though you and I know that's not what it is. So for Afropop, I used to say in the beginning, I wanted it to be like a mirror, to hold up a mirror to like the line. Like I come from a very style conscious people. So, and I don't mean style like the clothing, but like very aesthetically, like people were very like, we have a lot of flair, you know? So I wanted a place, online platform where I could show off, like, our flair. Like, we have so much flavor, right? Yeah. We're not just, like, downtrodden and, you know. So I wanted that, and I wanted Afropop to be that. So then I started Afropop in 2009.
Yeah. And this before Africa became hot.
Girl. Yeah, it was
I mean,
not
hot. I mean, 6 years ago, we were not hot then.
No.
Yeah.
Not the way we are now.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, it started off as just me, like, sharing my thoughts every couple of days and posting stuff. And then I had this amazing friend whom I had met in South Africa, and she had moved to London. And so one day I was like, I called her and I was like, can you, like, help me out? I know you've got the same kind of aesthetic and you're in London and you're coming at it from a UK version, like, UK eye of African aesthetic. So she was like, cool, let's do it. So we've been doing it ever since.
Yeah. And what I love about it is the images, first of all, are amazing and beautiful. So it's afropopmag.com.
Yes.
And also you're introducing even me to people that I'd never heard of or seen. I think a good friend had introduced me to Quab's music like ages ago. I'd totally forgotten about it.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God, Quab's. Yeah. Like, there's just some really amazing, really interesting articles and images. And I really, I feel like with the kind of expansion, right, of our brand, as a continent, it's really like the sky is sort of the limit.
Yeah.
Where would you like to take it? Like, where do you see as sort of a trajectory for Afropop Man?
I would really like us to become a, not just a publishing platform, but a place, you know, we do events, we do marketing for companies. So I really want to, it to become a multi, like, just a creative company, you know, where we're doing different things for companies. It's not just about, I want the written word to, you know, be there, but I think a model like what Fader does is a really a powerful model for me, because Fader, yes, it's a print magazine, but they're also run by Cornerstone Magazine. Cornerstone Agency does like events and works a lot with Converse, which does the Converse Rubber Tracks event, not event, but like where any artist can go in and record their music. So they are also a marketing firm. So I would love for Afropop to become not just a publishing portal, but more of an experience generating company.
And so you organized, and I think you've done two, this amazing event called African Women Create, which is a brunch and a sort of a few hours of African women creatives getting together and kind of talking about just really exploring each other's work and sort of enjoying each other's company. So is that within that platform or is that a different, that's a different goal?
No, that's it's an Afropop event, but again, it's about the experience. Like, I'm really would love to for Afropop to become a company that gives people amazing experiences. So African Women Create was an experience, is an experience, because it's Afropop coming to life. Because sometimes, you know, you read, and it's like, I want to know who these women are. I want to feel what this means. So the African Women Create brunch is a way for us to meet each other and also us to celebrate African women in the creative arts, because I don't think we get enough shine. Between you and I, we know so many amazing, my God, African women, like in film, in television, fine art, and I think we just don't get the cred that we deserve. And I wanted the African Women Create to be a place where we celebrate that, and we get to know each other, and we create a network amongst each other of you know, to build bridges between each other, and just be a what I would like even for that is for it to become bigger. Like, I look at Black Girls Rock and I'm like, oh, I want to do that. I want to do that.
The continent brand, right? And I feel I'm excited about the possibilities, but a part of me is also weary because, as with everything, I think with the entire continent, we're commodified often and we don't really get the benefit of it. And so I also worry that we can, you know, we can get to that point. But I feel like more than ever, young kind of Africans in the diaspora, and I think you are such a huge part of that, have their hands sort of in the pulse of things and are actually doing the work, which is really, which is really exciting.
I think that's an interesting point, Bosayo, because just the other day I was talking to someone about when your new colonizer looks like you. So you're getting a lot of people from outside the continent, going into the continent and doing business, right? They're doing the same thing people, white people did, but they're Black. And it's like, well, we have to address that. It's happening too often where people come and they, for example, Essence, I work at Essence, and Essence is doing the Essence Festival in South Africa. And we had to have come to Jesus moments where it's like, guys, you can't go to South Africa and think that you're going to bring an American model and it's going to work. Because the South African consumer has very different needs from the American consumer. So you can't go there and be like, okay, we're going to give you Mary J. Blige and Beyonce and that's it. No, that person wants to see, yes, they want to see Beyonce, but they want to see
you know, I don't know, some artists, Debange, yeah.
They
want to
see
They want to see Wizkid.
Davido.
Not just about... So I think it's beautiful that a lot of sort of African-Americans are doing business there, but also don't come there thinking that you know better than us. Because, it's not the way it is. And I think a lot of people have had to have that education. Like, you can't go anywhere in the world and think that you know better than the people that are already there, that live and breathe and work and do business in that situation. Just because you're American, it doesn't work.
No, it's funny that you said that, because I was looking at the list of the Black Girls Rock, the artists they had, and I was like, and it was like Mary J. Blige and all these people, and I'm like...
That was the critique.
Yeah,
that
you're really missing a huge... I mean, but they'll learn.
They'll learn. People may not... They'll, you know, everyone has to learn some way or other.
And you're also a singer.
Yeah.
Your song Sanguini, I love.
Oh, nice.
I listened to it. It was so beautiful.
I need to take that off. I don't
know. Why?
I don't like that word. I look horrible, first of all.
You look like an artist sharing her gifts. What? Please don't. That's so beautiful. Then film another one, but you can't just take it off.
Yeah, maybe I need to film another one.
Because the song...
I didn't even know we were recording.
But I have to tell you about that song. This is because I listened to several versions of it, and I listened to the version that you did a public performance, which you looked fabulous.
Yeah.
But I have to tell you, in terms of like what really connected and what got me to just like zoom into you and zoom into the song and really connect with what you were singing, it was absolutely the one that you wanted to take off. You know?
The one where I look horrible.
It was amazing. Did you write that song?
I did.
Oh my God. What inspired it?
That song
is
about...
It's on YouTube, everyone. Yeah. Sangweni. It's gorgeous. Before
that song
she takes
is actually
it off.
About, I know. That song is about police brutality. And it's all about sort of a policeman coming in and roughing up this black boy. And so it was written maybe about 6-7 years ago. I don't know what was the... It may have been Amadou Diallo that inspired that song. I have not visited that song in a long time, so I don't... I know it was about police brutality, but I think it probably was spurred, because I was living in America when I wrote that song. Mm. That song woke me up in my sleep, by the way. And you know, when you are, for some people, when you make music or poetry or
creative
whatever,
person,
you just wake up and it wakes you up like I have to be.
No, the muse is contacting you.
Yeah,
not
it's
being
like,
your,
wake up.
Yeah,
and get so that song woke me up out of my sleep and I wrote it.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Do you get visited by the muse a lot? Like, do you have that in terms of your songwriting or even articles and essays that you write?
Yeah. Always. Always. But also on the music front, I had to... Because, you know, when you do many things... I write, I sing, I do run this website. So I've had a lot of criticism from people, like snide remarks, right? Like, basically when you make music, everyone thinks that when you make music, you want to be Beyonce. And it's like, no, there is something about when you have a creative mind and I make music because it helps me live. You know, it's not because it's like I'm trying to be famous. I just make music because it's in me and it has to come out. And if it doesn't come out, there's a problem. It's not a happy Yolanda, you know? Mm-hmm. So it can be very difficult to be someone who is, I won't say just gifted, but is pursuing all the things that I think I have the right to pursue. But it can also be very difficult in the way that it isolates you, because people are like, well, what are you? You're this, you're that. Like, you have to choose. And it's like, why do we have to choose? You know?
Yeah.
So it's been a very interesting identity thing. But I'm getting older now, and I'm just like, fuck it. You know, if you don't like it, then...
I love it.
Because if I don't pursue the things, as you know, if I don't pursue the things that my spirit wants me to pursue, then it becomes a problem.
Yeah. It absolutely eats at your very being.
Yeah.
And it's funny, because as the fashion designer who hosts a podcast and writes and does all these other things, people say the same thing. and you have to serve it. You have to serve your different muses or else.
Yeah.
Like, do you think... So in terms of songwriting, is that... Do you sort of write a lot of songs, or do you typically mostly sing other people's songs? Like, what sort
of... Oh, I write a lot of songs. Mm. Yeah, most of the songs I sing, I write.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you sing as a part of a group as well, right?
I do, even though we're on a hiatus right now.
Okay.
But I do most of the songs that... Yeah, most of the songs I sing, I write. And I have to say, I'm a pretty fucking good songwriter.
And Beyonce cannot do that. I don't care what it says in her liner notes. She does not write those songs.
There are some
songs.
Things in life you're just like, you know what? Damn. Okay. Like, and it's good. Not just you. Like, it's you acknowledging the gift. Mm. I'm just acknowledging the gift. My God. Those moments I'm just like, where did that come from? It didn't come. It was not me. It is. I'm a vessel, you know? So I'm acknowledging that gift. It's powerful.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we have to wrap this up. I could talk to you for hours. Yeah. But... for people that have, you know, the muses hovering over them, they haven't quite found the way or the language in which to honor that gift.
Yeah.
Is there any advice or wisdom that you would want to share with such a person who knows that there's things that they're meant to be doing, but somehow cannot compel themselves to do it?
Yeah.
Or perhaps they're doing it and they're like, no one's engaging with this stuff. No one likes it. It's not working out. You're a year and a half after Trace, where you were like looking for a job and you were like,
yeah,
what am I going to do? Like, any words of wisdom?
Well, I think first I can say, even with Afropop, right, it's not some major website, right? So sometimes I feel like we're just writing in the dark. We don't know. Like, there's so many times my partner and I were like, oh my God, like, why are we doing this? Because the reward, what is the reward? We don't have the financial reward. We're doing it because we know we have to do it. There's no choice, even though there's no money, and a lot of times it's you're not, what's the word, not thanked, what's the,
oh, it's a thankless job.
It's a thankless job.
Yeah.
But we do it because we're passionate about it, and I think, I don't really think I'm in a position to give anyone advice, but I'll try. I feel like the moments when you're feeling like, yo, I hate my life, fuck that kind of moment, that's the moment when it's probably because you need to create something and you need to let it out. You need to express something and you need to get something out of your, you know, just do something, get something out of your creative expression. Because I think a lot of times we run away from our creative expression because we don't have the tools or we don't have the compass to say, oh, okay, well, this means that I need, you know, I need to go maybe sing. Because for me, singing is like, it's sound healing. Like, I recognize that when I sing, I'm healing my body. You know, it's not just me singing frivolously, especially I need it, you know? So I think when you're, I don't, like I said, I don't know if I can give advice, but I feel like the Nike thing of just do it is the most perfect way to kind of sum up what it means. Like, you do it or else you're not going to be, you're not alive. Of course, you're breathing, but there's something about being spiritually and connected to your chi, and just like, I feel like that's, you have to do it. You just have to push through and do it. Or you can just come to our brunches and we can do a kumbaya with us and we'll get it out. You have to get it out.
Oh.
You have to get it out. I don't know if it's like that for you too.
No, you absolutely have to. And whenever I'm not creating...
Yeah.
Whenever I'm feeling run down or it's not working or jealous, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes
jealous.
The sort of feeling of like, let me look at this other person's success, right? And it's usually because I'm not creating and I'm not putting out what it is I want to see in the world. And the minute I focus on my own path and my own work, those feelings dissipate.
They dissipate.
Yeah. But I think that, and part of why I wanted to start this podcast was really to talk about that struggle to really serve the muse, right? If it's either from resistance, right? Because you just don't, you're lazy, you're tired, you have made all these excuses, what are people going to think? Or you're trapped in an office job and you feel like, I'm not really an artist, but you have a yearning to do something else.
Yeah.
And how do you weave all of these strands together?
Yeah.
And I just thank you so much for doing this. This was so fun.
Yeah, I could talk to you forever.